Feels like fall, doesn't it? So that means it's about time for our practice period to start. This weekend we'll begin. And everyone is welcome to participate in whatever way works for you in this practice period. It's just a way for each person to kind of give their practice a little boost, or a big boost, depending on what feels right for you. So feel free to sign up, even if you feel like you can't do that much. Just do what gives you a little boost, and know that you're doing it along with everybody else. So take a look at the practice period form online. It says practice period guide and registration. And there's a whole list of things, but that doesn't mean you have to do every single thing on that list. You can choose, I think I can do this. And it just intensifies, just strengthens your practice that little bit. It's nice to know that everybody's doing it at the same time. So over the past few weeks, we've been doing a warm-up. We've been doing a review or an introduction for some of you of some of the fundamental teachings of Buddhism. We've looked at the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, the Three Marks of Existence. And today I want to talk about a really key concept that many people wonder about: karma. Karma has become kind of an easy buzzword in our culture. It's attached to everything from nail salons to car dealers. I actually saw this. To cleaning products, to a company called Credit Karma that helps you clean up your credit card debt, among other things. But the word karma simply means action. It's what we do. Particularly in terms of our volitional or intentional actions. So it's what we do and say in our everyday lives. And the word karma also refers to the effects of our actions. And the principle of karma, sometimes it's called the law of karma, but I like principle a little better. The principle is most simply that harmful actions lead to harmful effects and beneficial actions lead to beneficial effects. So sometimes it's called the law of cause and effect. If our actions are motivated by what are called the three poisons in Buddhist thought, greed, aversion, or ignorance, they'll produce suffering. And if our speech and actions are motivated by wisdom and compassion, they'll produce well-being and happiness. Sounds like a simple formula, but it isn't. It's vastly more complicated than that. Vastly more complicated than the way it's commonly construed. The principle of karma is most simply taught this way. The effects of our actions, good and bad, will come back around to us sooner or later in this lifetime or a future lifetime, so that the more karmic merit we accrue, the better our chances of a favorable rebirth. You're probably all familiar with that equation. And vice versa. The more bad karma we accrue, we are likely to be reborn in a worse position. I tend to think of this as the banking model of karma. It's all about credits and debits. Working our way towards the ultimate reward of complete enlightenment, or stepping off the wheel of birth and death. So as you can see, the teaching of karma is often closely paired with the doctrine, shall we say, of reincarnation, in a way that can make it quite difficult for Western rational materialists to accept, who might otherwise have an affinity with Buddhist teachings. There's a tendency to dismiss karma and rebirth as religious doctrine, superstition. The Tibetan teacher Traleg Khyabjong, in his book Karma, What It Is, What It Isn't, Why It Matters, makes a distinction between the Hindu belief in reincarnation, which is based on the continuity of a soul taking successive bodily incarnations, between that and the Buddhist concept of rebirth. Maybe you have asked, as I have, if the Buddha taught no enduring separate self, then what is reincarnated? Traleg Rinpoche calls what is transferred or continues after death a collection of psychic elements or materials. So I don't know if he's playing with semantics between reincarnation and rebirth. To be truthful, I have not heard or read a really satisfying description of what happens. And I think that's because the nature of consciousness, which extends beyond our conventional notions of space and time, is something that is still beyond our scientific, not to mention our everyday comprehension. I'll come back to this. So it's very easy to oversimplify karma, or to take a pop culture view, or even what I would call a fundamentalist view of it. For one thing, karma is not good or bad luck, or good or fortune. People will say, oh, you must have good karma if you win a lottery, or you must have bad karma if you get in a car accident. But that's not karma. And karma is not a neat and tidy tit-for-tat equation. If you let someone else take an open parking space today out of the kindness of your heart, someone else is not going to let you have a parking space tomorrow. Sorry. Unless you're lucky. Or if I do something bad to you in this lifetime, you're not going to come around and hit me back in the next lifetime. I don't think it's that neat and tidy. There are many other forces of cause and effect in the phenomenal world. The laws of physics, for example. There are geographical, climatic, and historical factors that have profound effects on our lives. So, though all those people who died or lost their homes in the recent hurricane in the Bahamas did not simply have bad karma, although a fundamentalist view might argue that. But how they dealt with those hardships, whether they came to the aid of others if they were able, or took advantage of others' misfortune, that's karma. That's karma. And why one person gets a particular cancer and someone else doesn't, I don't think can be reduced to karma. There are complex causes and effects involved, which may include so-called lifestyle factors like smoking or diet, but even those cannot be reduced to blaming bad karma. There are other factors that enter in. All risk factors exist in a complex interaction between genetic and environmental elements. How one lives, like Louise's brother, like she just told us, how one lives in the face of a cancer diagnosis, that's karma. that affect many others as you go through the course of that illness. Yeah? Karma is further complicated by the simple fact that we human beings are not neatly divided into good and bad people. Right? We're all a mixture of motivations and confusion. Most of our actions are not pure. Most of our actions are either subtly or grossly contaminated by those three poisons: greed, aversion, ignorance. Even our seemingly best of intentions can get muddled, right, by a little bit of self-interest here or there, right? We've all seen how that works. And of course, then, there's also the collective context of social and historical and cultural factors that influence us. The dire situation of social and ecological instability in our world right now is forcing more and more leaders and practitioners of spiritual and religious traditions to take up the question of how we can take both individual and collective responsibility for the harmful actions that have led us, the greed, aversion, and ignorance that have led us to this situation, that have caused harm to each other, to earth systems, and to other beings. Classical Buddhist teachings on karma have often been used to explain or justify the most egregious collective acts of cruelty and injustice towards groups we define as being other or less than fully human. While these acts have been sanctioned by our social and political and religious institutions, they're carried out by individuals. And we are called upon as bodhisattvas to take responsibility, both individually and collectively, and to see clearly the deep roots when harm is done. Classical Buddhist teachings on karma describe our thoughts, our words, and our actions as karmic seeds that germinate and sprout and grow and come to fruition over span of time, maybe quickly, maybe over a long span of time. And I think whether or not you find the concept of rebirth and successive lifetimes helpful, you can observe the way the consequences of our actions and unfold and extend and flow outward and onward beyond our view, right? Into the future. There's a lovely children's book I failed to find on my shelf. I looked for it, so I can't. And it's called something like, let's say, about a little boy, say his name is Sam, when Sam hugged his mom. So Sam gets up in the morning, gives his mom a big hug before he goes off to school, and it makes his mom feel so good that she goes to the store and does something nice, or says something nice, or smiles. And then it gets passed along and passed along and passed along from one person to the next, this kind and loving energy. And it's a beautiful child's explanation of karma. And I'd have to check the book, but I don't think it comes neatly back around to him. Because the chain of cause and effect from some kindness we do doesn't necessarily wind back around to us, but some different chain of karma might come to us. So I just think that it's so much that this is an explanation, you know? Probably every spiritual tradition in human history has taken up this problem of good and evil, how to get people to behave in ways that promote harmonious relationships based on kindness, respect, and generosity, and to how to prevent people from being selfish and violent and greedy. All too often, moral principles and rules have been applied primarily to those of our own clan, our own tribe, and those outside our sphere of care and concern are not so kindly treated, are excluded for all kinds of reasons of difference, right? Race, religion, gender, etc., political persuasion. And most religions have created stories that serve to make sense of this dilemma, right? This dilemma of good and evil. Stories that are, that motivate us, hopefully, to behave. But it seems to me that fear hasn't been that effective at getting human beings to behave well. Whether it's fear of hellfire and damnation, or fear of karmic retribution at some point in the future, it's most often not strong enough to trump strong greed or aversion in the present moment, right? Those strong reactivities that lead us to do harm. You know, fear of future punishment seems a long way off. It seems to me that what is most effective in motivating not only our individual but our collective behavior is an evolving and deepening and expanding understanding of connection and care for others beyond our contracted sphere of concern. So if this outcome of our actions can be so far beyond our present view, how can we, short-sighted human beings, maintain our intention to act in beneficial ways? Well, basically, our practice is to purify our karma by letting go of the hindrances. The hindrances are what cloud our clear mind. The classic hindrances are greed, aversion, agitation, sluggishness, and doubt. And those are all arise. You can see every single one of those arise in your experience, just sitting in meditation, right? And you can see how those cloud the mind, distort our view, and then distorting our thoughts, distort our speech and our actions. So that's what we practice with, and we practice by simplifying and sitting in zazen and paying attention. Do we need to believe in reincarnation to embrace this principle of karma? Certainly there are Buddhist teachers, particularly in the Theravadan and Tibetan traditions, who would say yes, unequivocally. But Zen tends not to emphasize the doctrinal aspects of karma. In Zen, we value the capacity for not knowing. Can we be comfortable with the limits of our understanding of what consciousness is? And can we be pragmatic about our practice as the Buddha himself was? He used the language of his times to explain karma to his followers, but he was reluctant to be pinned down when it came to questions of metaphysics. In a talk that he gave to a clan of people called the Kalamas, he encouraged them to follow the Eightfold Path and free their minds from ill will. And he said, if you do that, if there's a world after death, I'm quoting now, if there is a world after death, if there is the fruit of actions rightly and wrongly done, then this is the basis by which, with the breakup of the body after death, you will reappear in a good destination, the heavenly world. But if there is no world after death, if there is no fruit of actions rightly or wrongly done, then here in the present life, you look after yourself with ease, free from hostility, free from ill will, free from trouble. So as you can see, the Buddha was pragmatic. What he taught, and he would insist upon this when people tried to probe with metaphysical questions. You know, I teach suffering and freedom from suffering. So how do we influence our karma? Let alone our credit rating. We come back to the Eightfold Path that we discussed the last time, not last week, 2 weeks ago. That scaffolding of practices, that resilient, light, flexible scaffolding of practices that support awakening, and in particular, to mindfulness. There are two traditional components of mindfulness. Clear comprehension, which is awareness of our present state. So we know when we're having an angry defensive reaction. We can bring awareness to that and breathe and be present and take a step backwards from that nasty response that's only going to make things worse. And find a place of careful, skillful response. So there's clear comprehension, and then the other part of mindfulness is called suitability of purpose. And that's, is my action skillful or not? Is it appropriate or not? So first there's the mindfulness of your present state, and then the awareness of the appropriateness of your speech, your action. So this practice of mindfulness allows us then to extend to right speech and right conduct and right livelihood, the other three more of the Eightfold Path. So that's good karma. One way karma is taught is something called the 12 links of interdependent co-arising. It's a mouthful. It's a mouthful in Pali too. Pratitya samutpada. And along with the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, this is what traditionally was said the Buddha realized in his awakening experience under the Bodhi tree and then taught in his earliest teachings. The 12 links describe how our states of delusion arise from distorted perceptions, feelings, cravings, and actions, which perpetuate then our cycle of grasping at, and then leading to rebirth. These causal links can seem really abstract and a little hard to follow, so I am not going to try and explain the 12-fold, the 12 links of interdependent co-arising tonight. If you want to learn more about them, the best explanation I know of is Thich Nhat Hanh's, the great Vietnamese teacher, in his book called The Heart of Buddha's Teaching. And the nice thing about his presentation is that he shows the 12 links as a circle and then a parallel 12 links of each of these factors unobstructed, how they function with a clear mind, a clear unobstructed mind. But I think even without this kind of somewhat complicated and detailed model of the 12 links, we can observe the way our conditioned habit patterns distort our thoughts, speech, and action. In everyday life, happens all the time, right? We can let go of that conditioning with each breath, opening to the truth that we are more than an assemblage of identifiers that we typically call ourselves. we can open up space in our mind to feel directly, not know intellectually, but feel directly how we are connected intimately with all beings and systems on this earth and beyond. And we can come to know deeply that everything we do or say or don't do or say flows onward and outward without limit, beyond what we can imagine. Each of you matters because you are alive and conscious in this particular body-mind that will never be repeated. That's karma. So how will you live this life? How will you purify the karma of this life? Yours, mine, ours together. You can't do it by yourself, actually, because you aren't by yourself. We can only do it together. So that's my pitch for karma tonight. Thank you for listening.